Lord, save us from having just another lecture. That would be awful. Let this be a time when your truth comes alive. Let it be a time when we encounter you in a fresh way. A time when our spirits are lifted. Thank you, dear Lord, that you love your Son, Jesus Christ. Help us to see him afresh this morning. Fall in love with him all over again. In his name, amen. You only need one verse today. You can turn to it now. It's in John chapter 5. It may take us a little while to get there. But you've been good this morning, so we'll... you'll probably find this session a little bit easier. And I want to tell you about a day that I spend, well, just about lunchtime actually, in a university in the north of England. It was a Tuesday, part of a whole week of mission that I was having in that particular university. There were a lot of meetings, and they were all going more or less according to plan, until Tuesday lunchtime, when my host took me into a dining room that was just kept for the faculty. It was a very nice dining room, very pleasant, deep pile carpet, polished wood tables, good menu, waitresses in little black dresses and white aprons and caps and things. And it all looked very promising, in fact, apart from one thing. And that was that all the tables were facing in the same direction, and they were facing one small table where three places had been laid. And it looked a bit suspicious to me, especially when my host took me round to that little table, and he took the middle seat and asked me if I'd sit on his right. So I asked him, I said, who is going to occupy that other chair, the other side of you? And he said, it's funny you should ask me that, there's somebody I want you to meet. And I said, yes, I thought it might be. Who is it? And he said, well, his name wouldn't mean anything to you. So I said, then don't tell me his name. Just describe him. And he said, well, he'll be here soon, then you'll see him. And I said, yes, but I would like to know before he gets here. And he said, well, you're not going to. And that was the end of that. So we just chatted. The room filled up. And all these highly intellectual people carrying on highly intellectual conversations. Until the door opened, in came a very distinguished looking gentleman. And everybody stopped talking and watched in silence as he came round until he stood looking down at me. And he said, you must be Mr. Needham. And I said, yeah. He said, and you are a Christian. And I said, yes. Let me shake your hand. I didn't believe there would be any Christians left in these days of advanced learning and discovery. And he went and sat in the other seat. And people were sort of looking up, and I assumed that I was supposed to say something. So I said, yes, I'm a Christian. How would you describe yourself? And he said, I am an atheist. That, of course, is someone who says very definitely, there is no God. I said, oh, it's most interesting. Tell me, what do you do around here? It was a slightly insolent way to put the question because he was obviously quite an important person. So I said, yeah, tell me, what do you do around here? And he looked down a long, distinguished nose and he said, I am the dean of the Faculty of Science, and I lecture in physical chemistry. So he's actually the head man on the whole science side of the university. So I said, you know, that is really interesting. You'd call yourself a scientist then. He said, I don't call myself a scientist, I am a scientist. I said, really? Let me shake your hand. I didn't think anybody could be a scientist and an atheist. And now we really had an interesting atmosphere building up in this place. People were definitely awake. And he said, "What on earth do you mean? It's a perfectly reasonable position. I'm an atheist and I am a scientist." I said, "Well, you're telling me there's no God?" And he said, "Yes." "Well, then I'd be most interested in hearing your evidence that there's no God." He said, "I would be most interested in hearing your evidence that there is a God, if you have any." And I said, "Just a minute. I didn't say there is a God. You said there isn't a God. So we'll take your evidence first, if you don't mind." He said, "Don't be ridiculous. You cannot have evidence that something does not exist." I said, "I know. And it is ridiculous, but it's not my position, it's yours." "Well, when you finish playing verbal games, I'd still be interested in your evidence that there is a God, if you have any." So I said, "Well, since you don't have any, we'd better take mine." And mine is called Jesus Christ. "Jesus Christ? That's not evidence." "Hey, just a minute. He was a real figure in human history. He performed miracles, and he rose from the dead, and that is evidence." "Oh, the miracles. You're not seriously expecting we're going to believe those, are you?" And I said, "Do you have difficulty accepting the miracles?" "Utter nonsense. Nobody with half a mind could believe those. They might have been made up by Grimm along with their other fairy tales." And I said, "No. Well, would you like to choose one?" "Why should I choose one? They're all the same. Just nonsense." "Well, I wish you would choose one, because I want to be fair to you. See, and miracles are not your territory. You don't know anything about them because you're a scientist. Miracles are my territory because I'm a Christian. And since we're going to talk about my territory, you at least ought to have the advantage of choice. Which miracle do you want to talk about?" "Yeah, very well then. Wasn't he supposed to turn water into wine or something?" "Yes, he was. He did do that. Just to make sure we all know the details, it was a wedding. And their weddings lasted several days. And they were quite enjoyable events. And at this particular one, they were just about out of wine. And before it became public knowledge, they came to Jesus and put the situation before him. And he indicated some large stone pots full of water that were used for washing. And he said, 'Serve that to the guests.' And the guests in the guest chamber had no idea about that conversation that had taken place in a side room. They served that to the guests, and the chief guest was handed a glass with some of this wine in it, or some of this stuff in it. And he took it, just like all the others he'd taken, sipped it, and suddenly he stopped, and his eyes lit up, and he smiled and he said, 'Hey, this is good stuff. It's not like that cheap rubbish you've been giving us all along. This is different. This is really good wine.' You know, most people, they give us the good wine to begin with, then when they think we're too drunk to know the difference, then they give us the cheap stuff. You have done it the other way around. This is excellent. My congratulations." See, now there was a man who understood wine, knew what it looked like, knew what it tasted like, knew how it smelt, and he recognized this as good wine, mature wine. The people who were there and saw it and experienced it and drank it themselves wrote about it. Not only did they write about it, they committed their lives to Jesus Christ because of what happened then. And they became disciples of his and later on died for him. And they were convinced about this. And what they say is evidence because they were there. We were not there, but they were, and that's what they said. The dean looked around the room and he said, "Well, there you are. See, nobody's going to believe that, are they? Utter nonsense." I said, "You have difficulty believing that Jesus could turn water into wine? Impossible. Have you never seen water turn to wine?" "No, have you?" "Yes." "I beg your pardon. I said, yes. When? Hundreds of times. Where? All over the place. I don't believe you. Well, I know. That's your problem. See, I have seen water turn to wine hundreds of times. All over the place. Have you ever seen a grapevine? What does a grapevine do? It puts its roots down into the soil and it drinks what? Water, as far as I understand. And out of the other end, you get grapes, which contain grape juice, which is essentially what? Hey, isn't that amazing? All the wine in the world was once water, right? Jesus was different from most of us in that Jesus could see and most of us can't. We suffer from blindness of eye. And when Jesus looked at the grapevine, he saw something absolutely fantastic. He saw a plant that knew how to turn water into wine, which is quite an involved process. In Britain, we don't grow grapevines because the climate doesn't really suit them. So in Britain, we don't turn water into wine. What we do in Britain, in very large quantities, is we turn water into beer. See, I'm not necessarily recommending the process, but it happens a great deal in Great Britain. How do we turn water into beer? We do it in a thing that used to be called a brewery, but should probably be called a chemical factory. And it turns water into beer. What's a chemical factory like? Big, ugly, noisy, and dirty. But it does turn water into beer. See? Now, when God wanted to turn water into wine, why did he want to do that? Well, water was kind of ordinary, and a lot of it wasn't very safe, and Coca-Cola were not yet in business, so he turned it into wine instead. And when he wanted to turn water into wine, he didn't build a chemical factory, he designed a grapevine. Unlike a chemical factory, a grapevine is not big, it's quite small. And while grapevines are not particularly beautiful, they're certainly better looking than chemical factories are. And I have yet to meet a noisy grapevine. Every grapevine I've ever listened to was absolutely silent. It just kind of sits there turning water into wine, but you can't hear it. And grapevines are not dirty either. As a matter of fact, they clean up our atmosphere for us. They take out the carbon dioxide that you breathe out and that our cars and machinery produces and pump back in oxygen into the air so we can breathe a little longer. It's very nice of them to do that. So here this grapevine sits, being small and decorative and quiet and clean, but at the same time turning water into wine. See? Now when Jesus looked at the grapevine, he saw what an amazing plant it really was. Something that the Father had produced in nature. An object of the Father's beautiful creative design. A little biochemical miracle, turning water into wine. And he says, if you look with me in John 5, verse 19, Jesus gave them this answer, I tell you the truth, the Son can do nothing by himself, he can only do what he sees the Father doing. Because whatever the Father does, the Son also does. And when Jesus looked at the grapevine, he saw the Father turning water into wine. When other people saw grapevines, they didn't even see them. They were just grapevines. They were all over the hillside, just grapevines. When they had a glass of wine on their table, it was just a glass of wine. They never saw the amazing process that had turned it from water into wine because they were blind. They don't see the miracle in nature. Most people don't. They're blind. But Jesus was amazed and thrilled at this little plant called a grapevine. And in that, he saw the Father turning water into wine, and he says, I only do what I see him do. If he turns water into wine, then I turn water into wine. And so he did. He didn't, of course, grow a grapevine, wait for the grapes to ripen, pluck them all off, take his shoes and socks off, walk on the grapes to squeeze out the juice, collect it, let it settle, decant it, let it settle again, decant it again, bottle it for 5 years until it was ready. You see, if he'd done that, they might have got thirsty before the process was finished. So he didn't do exactly the same process, but he did the same change, water to wine. It was only a little miracle because there are only about 160 gallons. See, the Father produces a few million every day, but Jesus just produced 160. No big deal, just a little amount, just for one wedding, that's all. Just different enough to call our attention to the fact that turning water to wine is quite a trick. See? Now, I was interrupted by the dean who said, "All right, enough of this. There is a glass of water on the table. You turn that into wine now, and I will take you seriously." I said, "Thank you. That is very nice of you. You've reminded me of one of the reasons why I believe in Jesus Christ. And one of the reasons why I believe in Jesus Christ is that I don't know how to turn water into wine. That's why I think it's remarkable that he did. Because he lived 2,000 years before me, and he didn't have a degree in chemistry. But he knew how to do it, and I don't. And I don't know anybody else who knows how to do it except him. That's why I believe in him. But I tell you what, you go back to your laboratory and make me a grapevine, or even a seed, and I'll grow my own, and I'll take you seriously." Do you know, he didn't know how to make a grapevine. He really didn't. Which would you say is the bigger miracle? Creating a grapevine out of nothing, or turning 160 gallons of water into wine? Which is the more difficult to do? Or if you like, which is easier? As far as I'm concerned, about the same. I don't know how to do either. And the only person I know who can do either can do both. He's God. Every miracle of Jesus transmits three messages. The first one says, "Man, you're blind. You are blind to the miracle in nature, blind to this amazing little plant called a grapevine that can turn water into wine. And the God who designed the grapevine to turn water into wine has just appeared to you again. He looks just like a man, but don't be put off by that simple human exterior. He has proved who he is by doing what only God can do, turning water into wine." So the miracle of Jesus is just different enough from the one in nature to draw your attention to the process. It's an amazing process. And it reveals that Jesus has the same creative power that God does. Now, the dean was unhappy, so I invited him to choose another miracle, and this time he chose the feeding of the 5,000. Five small bread rolls, such as a little boy would eat in one meal. Two small fish, similar, probably sardines. 5-6 inches long. Jesus took those, and somehow or other, out of those, 5,000 hungry people were all filled, and then there were 12 baskets full of fragments left over. And again, the dean was very skeptical. He looked around the room and he said, "You see what nonsense?" I said, "You have difficulty believing that Jesus could multiply food?" He said, "Of course. Food does not multiply." Do you know, if you get two sardines together in the ocean, By the end of a year, you have about 500 million sardines. It's quite exciting if you're a sardine. Of course, it does depend on the number of sharks that are around. But it seems to me that sardines multiply fairly successfully. And every year, farmers do the dumbest things. And you know it's because some of you come from farming countries. And here we are hungry, and these dumb farmers take perfectly good barley that could have been milled and ground into flour and baked into bread, and we could have eaten it. But they insist on taking out their tractors, plowing up the dirt, and burying perfectly good grains of barley. Why on earth does a farmer do such a daft thing? Well, because the farmer knows what apparently the dean doesn't know, that barley multiplies. And every day, you and I eat the product of multiplication. Some breakfast times, you may perhaps have a cardboard box in front of you. This is when you get up in time for breakfast, of course. And you're hungry, and you tear the top off the cardboard box, and you turn it the other way up, and you shake out the sun. And there is a golden cascade from the box into your dish, and you watch it with amazement, and you say, Kellogg's have done it again. Amazing. And there are walking around little two-legged egg factories. And there are walking around slightly larger four-legged milk factories. And you put green grass into a brown cow and you get white milk. And you walk by the golden arches and you see 60 billion hamburgers served to date out of three cows. Must be a miracle. And somehow or other, McDonald's keep on churning out hamburgers because hamburgers multiply. And somehow or other, the Colonel keeps on producing more chicken after he's dead. It's amazing. And hamburgers multiply and chickens multiply, and every day our plates have piled up again. But food doesn't multiply because the dean says so. You ever stop to think, if you could collect now, in its original state, all the food you've eaten since the day you were born, how much food there has been involved in getting you to your present state? Now, you probably eat rather more than average. Some of you certainly do. But we all actually eat more than average. But multiply that by 5,000 million, which is the current population of the earth. And everybody eats something if they don't eat as much as you do. Otherwise, they wouldn't be alive. How can 5,000 million people eat every day? Because food multiplies. And yet we sit down to the table and we say grace and we still don't see the miracle. Hey, so what does Jesus do? Well, he takes a few dead grains of barley and a couple of dead sardines and multiplies those. It's only a little miracle because there are only 5,000 people. A million times that many will eat today. Everybody says, oh, that can't happen. Why? See, Jesus' miracle is really the same as the one that's happening every day. Barley multiplies. Sardines multiply. You just don't see it. So he does it in a slightly different way and draws your attention to the fact that multiplying food is really quite a trick. And his miracle says, number one, you are blind to the natural miracle that has fed you every day. Number two, it says that the God who designed the sardine to multiply has just appeared to you again. Might look just like a man, but he's not. He's done what only God can do, multiply food. Now, of course, some people say about the barley and the sardines, well, that's natural. I don't believe that. That doesn't convince me of anything. That's natural. Then you say, but Jesus did it a different way. I don't believe that. Why not? That's supernatural. So if they won't be convinced by the natural and they won't accept the supernatural, what will convince them? Answer, nothing. Why? Because they don't want to be convinced. What's that called? Prejudice. It's not being scientific. It's not being intelligent. It's just being prejudiced. Anybody can be prejudiced. Dean is still not happy. I asked him to have another miracle. He chose to talk about the healing of the leper. He was very graphic about this because he had actually visited a leper colony. And he described a leper in an advanced state of leprosy. He has no ears. Good thing he doesn't wear glasses. His no nose and no lips, just one hole in the middle of his face. All that tissue is gone. All the rest of his skin is contaminated by the disease. The fingers have gone, and there is just a rotting stump where his hand used to be. The other one's the same. Most of his feet have gone. His entire body is affected. He says, and we are supposed to believe that this Jesus person came along and touched him. And bingo, he grew a new nose, new lips, new ears, and all the skin changed and became healthy. A new hand grew, another new hand grew. Oh, and look, there's some new feet too. Rubbish. I said, you find it hard to believe that Jesus could make a sick person well? He says, couldn't happen. And I said, why? Sick people don't get well. Really? What kind of people do get well? Suppose I cut myself. See, I'm not going to do it because I like myself too much, but suppose I do. Then the same blood that's been racing around my... the same blood which has been crawling wearily around my body for the last few days begins to come up out of the cut. It's a bad cut, so I take it to the doctor, who cleans it up, sews the edges together, covers it over. What does he not do? Heal it. Why doesn't he heal it? Doesn't know how. The same blood that's been going around my body forms a hard protective covering right across the open wound. It seals out everything that shouldn't get in. It seals in everything that should stay in. It holds the edges together, and then the skin knits itself together. When that's complete, then the anchorages of that hard covering loosen and it falls off, and my hand's repaired itself. I can be more graphic and break a bone. And I go into the doctor's office with it hanging down there. And the doctor looks at it and he says, hey, that's different. I haven't seen one like that. You want to keep that? And I say, well, actually, I liked it better the way it used to be. So he says, all right, I'll put it back for you. And I say, just a minute. Suppose you give me an anesthetic first. So he gives me an anesthetic, and then he straightens out the finger, and then he sets it in plaster. What doesn't he do? Heal it. Why not? Doesn't know how. Doctors don't know how to heal you. You know that, don't you? Don't labor under the misapprehension that they do. They don't. But that bone repairs itself. Actually, stronger at that point, if I'm under 65, which I am, by the way, stronger at that point than before I broke it, in case I'm daft enough to try and do it again. Okay. It's fairly remarkable, sophisticated technology. See? Can we, for instance, make cars like that? Suppose we could. See? So you borrow Bill Bushhouse's car, and you drive down to San Antonio and bump into a few friends. And then you come back with a slightly rearranged Volvo, and you get back up here, and you decide you're going to put it into the garage so that it won't be noticed. And you drive into the garage, but you drive a little close to that right-hand wall, and there is an ominous scraping sound as you come in alongside that wall on the right of your car. And you think, it's so boring using that same silly pedal to stop it every time. Let's just try a different driving technique. Let's see if the front wall of the garage will stop it. So you continue driving until you hit the front of the garage, and you find that actually that stops it much more effectively than the brakes did. There is, however, a tinkling sound as the glass falls out of the headlamps and the windshield. And there is a sort of dull clang as the front fender falls off onto the floor, a sort of scrunching noise as the overall length is reduced by about 2.5 feet. Okay. And Bill comes out looking definitely upset. Not about you, of course, just about the car. But he sees it, and he gets agitated, and he says, "Look at my car!" And you say, "Yeah. It's got no paint down the side." And you say, "No, but the garage looks a lot brighter, doesn't it?" He says, "It's got no glass in the headlamps, and it's 2.5 feet too short, and it's got no glass in the windshield, and it's got no fender on the front." And you say, "Hey, Bill, would you relax, man? Just relax. It'll be better in the morning. It'll grow some new glass and a new fender, and it'll kind of straighten itself out again overnight. Hey, wouldn't it be great if we could make cars like that? I would buy one for my wife tomorrow. But we really can't. The technology is a bit beyond us at the moment. But somebody designed you that way. And every one of us at some stage has cut ourselves, grazed a knee, scratched something, broken a bone, and it fixed itself. But we didn't notice, because we're blind. Even when the miracle takes place in our own body, we don't even see it. And Jesus just heals one leper. So what? Well, one day 10 lepers. It's only a little miracle. It's only a handful of people. It's just a little bit speeded up from the usual process that we see. And the miracle says, man, you are blind to the miracle in your own body. When you see that leper healed instantaneously, you say, wow, that's fantastic. But what's happened to you is no more fantastic. Just took a little longer. And then the miracle says the God who designed your body to heal itself has just appeared to you again. Don't be put off by that simple, ordinary exterior. He's God. He's done what only God can do. Heal the sick person. You see, each miracle also has a third message. When Jesus turns water into wine, he starts with the ordinary and he makes it special. He takes something that's very common, very cheap, very abundant, and he makes it exciting and valuable, different. And the problem with most people is simply this, that they live what you might describe as very, very ordinary lives. Except we don't use the word ordinary we use the word boring. And especially these days, young people in Great Britain use that word a lot. And they don't even say it anymore, they sing it. It goes, boring. You know? Hey, how was class today? Boring. You see television last night? Boring. What do you think of the Super Bowl? Boring. And everything is boring. They're hardly ever excited. Very seldom excited. Most of their days are spent being bored. You talk to older people. What do you do for a living? Work in a bank. Do you like it? No, it's kind of boring. What do you do it for? Got to get some money. So what do you do when you get home? Watch TV. Why do you watch TV? Passes the time. What happens when you finish watching TV? Go to bed. Then what? Get up. Then what? Go to the bank. And life's boring. Thousands of people bored. Although we've never had so much money, never had so many toys, never had so much entertainment, never had so many travel opportunities, never had so much education, never had so many books, never had things like video games and all the other things, never had the opportunity for most people to get to learn to ski if they want to, or go to the beach or whatever. And yet people are bored. But Jesus says, look, see what happened to that water? That water was put at my disposal. When it was completely at my disposal, it was poured out in the service of people the way I directed. And in the pouring out, it was transformed and the ordinary became exciting. You see, now listen, you've seen me do that with water. What I really want to do is I want to do that with your life. If you would actually give your life to me, and as I direct you, pour that life out to serve other people, in the pouring, the ordinary will become special. Jesus loves to make the ordinary, bored, fed-up character fresh and excited, but he does it by making you a servant, and you only experience it when you begin to serve. When he takes the feeding of the 5,000, various ways that you can understand that, the most obvious way is this. 5 rolls and 2 sardines, when you add them together, add up to pathetic. I mean, 5 rolls and 2 sardines for the needs of 5,000 hungry people, it's pathetic. You might as well not start. And when you compare your life or my life and your talents or my talents with the needs of the people we're supposed to minister to, it's pathetic. We might as well not begin. We don't have what it takes to do anything for them. But in the hands of Jesus, the pathetic became sufficient. In fact, 12 baskets full more than sufficient. And he's saying, look, you've seen me do that with 5 rolls and 2 sardines. Now let me do it with your life. Because in my hands, the pathetic, the unskilled, untrained, useless, becomes terrific. I believe that's one reason why Jesus chose the disciples he did. Because they were pathetic. There wasn't a PhD amongst them. There wasn't even a high school graduate amongst them. There were no fantastic talents. As far as we know, none of them could sing. None of them could even play the guitar. But somehow or other, those guys changed the world. In the hands of Jesus, the pathetic becomes more than sufficient. A while ago, I was in New York at a church there. Meeting started Saturday evening, Sunday morning, Sunday evening, Monday evening, Tuesday evening. By then, I was so frustrated, all I wanted to do was go home. Nothing happening, no response. desperate. Thought it was a complete waste of time. Home I was staying in was sort of interesting. Very strong-minded lady. Her husband did as he was told. The kids did as they were told. The dog did as it was told. And I tried hard. And when we got to church, it was a bit the same because she was the organist. And she sat there behind this huge, huge organ, clad in a particular kind of coat, bristling with nylon fur and self-righteousness. And she played that organ, it was a big organ, she played it at top volume. And even though there was a good sound system in that church, and using the sound system, my voice didn't get even near the volume that was coming out of that organ. See? And every fifth or sixth note she hit was not the one that I expected. But it was never predictable which note it would be that would be the unexpected one. Now, as I say, it was a huge organ, but there was actually one sound that was louder than the organ, and that was the lady herself. She had this massive pair of lungs and this colossal voice, and she was kind of a frustrated opera singer. And Sunday was her chance to demonstrate the full range of her vocal talents, and she did. And she was louder than the organ. The only thing was that every fifth or sixth note she hit with the voice was not an expected one. Neither was it the one she hit on the organ. And after two verses of one song, I gave up the unequal struggle entirely. It was really not worth it. And looking around the church, I realized that everybody else had given it up years ago. Tuesday night, we were back in the house after the meeting, and I was saying under my breath, "Lord, why did you bring me to this place? Get me out of here. Let me emigrate, anything." And we were sitting around the fire, having hot chocolate, when she said, "Do you know the world's sick?" I said, "What do you mean?" She said, "The world is sick, it's obvious." I said, "No, it's not obvious. You explain it to me." And she said, "Well, look at Northern Ireland." And she went off at great length about Northern Ireland, how everybody's killing each other over there. And she said, "You see, the world is sick." I said, "No, that's not the world, that's Northern Ireland." So then she began about Israel and the Arabs and how they're all blowing each other to smithereens. And she said, "You see, the world's sick." And I said, "No, that's the Middle East." Well, then she started on about you lot, the juvenile detergents. And what she didn't say about you wasn't worth saying. She gave you a terrible time. And she said, "You see, the world's sick." And I said, "No, that's the young people." So then she began about divorce statistics in America. And I glanced across at her husband, and his burning desire was to be the next one. And she said, "You see, the world's sick." And I said, "No, that's just married people." And then she went on about crime rates. And she said, "You see, the world's sick." And I said, hey, you've convinced me. Hey, this is really interesting. How about you?" "What? How dare you? And in my own house as well. Nothing wrong with me. If the whole world was like me, it'd be wonderful." I said, "Do you mind if I tell you something? If the whole world was like you, I would get off it." Now, I'm not going to pretend that she enjoyed that remark, or that I did either, for that matter. And I wish you could meet her now, because she's different. But she is something of a caricature of a very, very common attitude. See, she's neither the first person nor the last to say the world's sick. Everybody says that. But as soon as I turn that around, somebody tells me the world's sick, and I say, how about you? They say, I'm okay. And I'm left with this great mystery of a sick world with no sick people in it. Isn't that interesting? Mm-hmm. Do you believe the world's sick? Do you? If the world is sick, who are we talking about? Just other people? See, if you really believe the world is sick, what you're talking about is you and me. Otherwise, it's nonsense. We all suffer from a sickness called sin. Shows itself in various forms. The most common one is petty selfishness. But sin is like leprosy. It's a disease. It contaminates everything you touch. Everything you touch, everybody you meet, you contaminate them with sin. And especially your most valuable relationships. My most valuable relationship is my marriage. It's contaminated by sin. Not so much mine, of course, but it is. It shows itself up in various ways, like this one. See, both my wife and I find it difficult to get up early on a winter's morning while it's still dark and it's cold. Now, I know you don't have that problem. You just leap out of bed with a happy hallelujah, can't wait to get into the day. But both of us have difficulty getting up.